This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hi, I'm Shauna Meyerson with the Yoga of War podcast. Here today with political activist Rawan Osman. If you appreciate and find value in these important discussions, please consider supporting the show so I continue to bring you such amazing and esteemed guests. Details are pinned in the comments below. Rawan Osman didn't always love Israel. Well, love is a really, really strong word. Rawan didn't always like Israel. In fact, like most young Lebanese, Rawan was a staunch supporter, actually, of Hezbollah, the terrorist organization that literally exists for the sole purpose of destroying the Jewish state. So you can pick the positive emotion of your choice. It's fair to say that she did not feel that for Israel either. Well, she does now. Today, Rawan and I will discuss her astounding transformation from avowed anti-Semite to Arab Zionist, and in the process of becoming a Jewish Israeli. It's a story of personal awakening you won't want to miss. Rawan Osman, sorry my hair is such a mess today, is a Syrian-born German activist, public speaker, and content creator, advocating Arab-Israeli normalization and countering anti-Semitism in the Arab world. Raised in Lebanon in an anti-Semitic environment, she later became what she calls a recovered anti-Semite. She is the founder and chairwoman of Post-October 7th EV in Germany, an association dedicated to combating anti-Israel misinformation and promoting dialogue. Rawan has received multiple recognitions for her activism, including the White Rose Society Award in the United States and the Joseph Ben Issachar Susskind Oppenheimer Medal from the State Parliament of Baden-Württemberg. I'm really, really good with foreign words. My eloquence precedes me in Germany. She studied Islamic and Jewish studies at Heidelberg University and is featured in the documentary Tragic Awakening. Thank you so much for joining me today, and not just for joining me, but for joining me in my home. It's such a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. So I'd like to start, when somebody has a transformation that's been as dramatic as yours, it has to have started with a profound beginning. So you grew up in Lebanon, in a secular Muslim home. And in fact, you went to Catholic school, which is interesting. Could you tell us a bit about your upbringing and what you were taught about Israel and the Jewish people, both at home and in school?
Yes, indeed. It is not exceptional or special that I attended a Catholic school in the Middle East. We don't have the best public education.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not in Lebanon. So when you want a good education for your children, it's quite common to send them to missionary schools even back in the days when Jews lived in the Middle East, in many Arab countries, they would also send their children to the Alliance, for example, or to the Frères, because you learn foreign languages and the education is still one of the best available. My parents were secular, and they sent us indeed to a French Catholic school. My father is Sunni, my mom is Shiite Muslim. So the fact that they intermarried says a lot about this setup, about the family. We always had a Christmas tree at home because my father thought it was a very sweet tradition for kids. We didn't have any Jews living in our society, in the country, which applies to most of the Arab world by that time. We're talking about the mid-80s. And mid-80s, that was during, towards the end of the Lebanese Civil War, where the Lebanese literally killed one another, and society decided to become tolerant, decided to forget what divided them, what led them to this level of hatred. And I can say that I grew up in a progressive or liberal, secular, middle-class environment. The only thing everybody hated was the Jews, the Israelis, and the Zionists. And I say the three terms deliberately because they are used interchangeably. Until this day, we do not make a distinction between Jewish and Zionist. Everybody agreed that our common enemy, the worst enemy of humanity, is there in the south, the neighbors in the south, referring to the Jews and to Israel. And you mentioned earlier that I was one of Hezbollah's biggest fans. Indeed. And it was easy to grow fond of them because they were the only ones who dared defy the Israelis who were occupying South Lebanon. And we didn't know why Israel occupied South Lebanon. Nobody told us at the time, because that was before my time. That was that happened when my mother was a child. That for more than a decade, Yasser Arafat, armed Palestinian factions, abused Lebanese territory. They were joined by radical leftists from around the world, from Germany all the way to Japan, people who sympathized with the Palestinian cause and who joined their ranks to train. And occasionally they would send men and women to infiltrate the Israeli borders, and they committed terror attacks against Israeli civilians. Those assassinations or attacks against Israelis happened also in America, also in Europe. And at a certain point, Israel decided enough is enough. And they decided to create a buffer zone in South Lebanon to protect its northern borders, to stop them from infiltrating Israel. We didn't know all this. After that at school, and in Lebanon we have one curriculum. At school in history class, around the age of 12, 13, you learn one lesson about Palestine. The antagonist in that story is called Theodor Herzl. You learn that he invented, he created something called Zionism. And according to his plan, the Jews who come from Eastern Europe are now going to come live in the Middle East and steal Palestine. You also learn the date of the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. And you learn the date and the content of the Balfour Declaration, which implied that the West enabled the Zionist project. Now, there are many problematic aspects to this very simplistic story. But I think in hindsight, the most problematic aspect is the fact that we internalized that Palestine was a country. So these are a few reasons. Also, I attended a French Catholic school where we learned that the Jews killed Jesus that they could have spared this life. Instead, they spared the life of a thug. Add to that, that everybody told a consistent story. The politicians, the journalists, your parents, the teachers, they told the same story about Israel. Why wouldn't you hate them? Especially that there were no Jews to contest whatever we were told about them. That is what we knew about them. And bear in mind that I lived through several wars with Israel, and it was, even as a child, it was unmistakable. You wouldn't confuse Israeli jets with any other sounds. You knew.
Right.
So with that, mm-hmm. with all that, with all these details, I think it becomes rather easy or evident to hate the Israelis and the Jews.
I have to be honest, I'm surprised that you learned that much in depth about Zionism. I don't even remember, I went to Jewish school, I don't remember learning about Herzl or, you know, about any Zionist movement. But then again, growing up, there was no question that the Jewish state existed, and that was our story, right? There was no contesting it. So I guess we didn't feel back then that we had to defend it. But it's interesting to me as well that it wasn't just the Muslims, but also the Christians that were propagating this severely anti-Semitic narrative.
I don't think it's surprising at all. Whether you're Christian or Muslim, of course, the majority in the Arab world are Muslims, but whether Christian or Muslim, you live in the same political environment mm-hmm. and you express or you feel the same hostility mm-hmm. against the Israelis because mm-hmm. they are cut off. Since Israel became a country in 1948 or shortly afterwards, since the 50s, there were campaigns, political campaigns to boycott the Jewish state. You wouldn't even say Israel because you don't want to acknowledge it existed.
Would you say Jewish state or Zionist entity?
Zionist entity, occupying entity, the enemy, the neighbors in the south. People refused to say Israel. And those boycott campaigns included anti-normalization mm-hmm. laws and policies forbidding people-to-people contact between citizens of those Arab countries and Israelis, even abroad. So you're not allowed to speak to Israelis, even if you meet them in Cyprus or in Canada. So after decades of boycotts, of estrangement, you would believe anything you are told about the Israeli. It actually contributed in dehumanizing the Jew, right. demonizing the state, but also dehumanizing the Jew. This is why on October 7th, many Arabs knew, they saw on social media what Hamas has done, but it was very difficult for them to sympathize, even with Jewish children, because especially the Palestinian leadership always says they will grow up to serve in the IDF. Mm-hmm. So that should make them a legitimate target. And not long ago, by the way, Mustafa Barghouti, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, mm-hmm. who's supposed to be civilized and moderate, said on Uncensored with Piers Morgan, when speaking about Israeli hostages, that they served in the IDF. Like when he was pushed in a corner that you've abducted civilians, he said they served in the past mm-hmm. in the IDF. And Piers Morgan pressed him on that. He said this is against international law. You cannot abduct someone who's 45 because once upon a time he had to do his military service.
Well, they also referred to, for example, Shiri Bibas, Kfir Bibas, and Ariel Bibas as soldiers.
Not prisoners of war. So they lied, they insisted that they only targeted soldiers, never ever a civilian. But then the first group of hostages was released, and we've seen among those released hostages, children and elderly, so they could no longer insist they only took civilians, so they never called them hostages. Mm-hmm. Even when somebody asks about the hostages, mm-hmm. they insist these are prisoners of war because they still live in the 7th century. Not only they refer to children as prisoners of war, I don't know if you noticed, if anybody recalls, when the Bibas were returned or paraded in this despicable, disgusting ceremony, on their on the caskets, it said in Arabic and in Hebrew, arrested, like date of arrest,
yep.
October 7th. How insane is that? How do you arrest a four-year-old? How do you arrest a baby?
There's no way to measure the insanity because they also sealed it shut with locks that they didn't give the keys to. They filled the caskets with propaganda flyers. And as we all know, the body that was claimed to be Shiri Bibas
wasn't even Shiri Bibas. Palestinian woman.
Yeah. The level of depravity, honestly, it can't be measured. It can't be construed by like the moral mind. But I want to take a step back because I have to be honest, growing up as a Jew in Los Angeles and Southern California, we grapple a lot with the very concept of anti-Semitism in how, God, where does it come from? What motivates people? So I'm wondering what you construed as the actual justification for the Jew hatred that you were taught to feel. Like, so was it Jews are religious infidels? Was it what you said, like they're military enemies? Was it that we're moral degenerates? Was it all of the things? Was it more of the things? Like, you strike me as somebody who is a very peaceful person at heart. So I'm wondering how the justification for hatred, like in your mind, what was it that was so unique about the Jews in Israel?
It's not an exercise of trying to understand psychologically why would I hate the Jews. Many decent people hate the Jews to death. How can you be a decent person and then hate the Israelis? Well, in the Arab world, I explained what you grow up with.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite normal when bombarded with such intensive indoctrination.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite normal that you internalize all this and it becomes normal. Why? What is behind such Jew hatred in the Arab world? Today, we see it as a political problem, but the motivation is religious, in my opinion. This political issue conflict could have been solved ages ago had the Palestinian leadership, and back then, the Arabs of Palestine, they were leaders who were willing to collaborate, to negotiate, to cooperate with the Zionists. But the louder voices, the bigots, refused to work with the Zionists categorically. There were no deals to be made with them. And one of the nastiest creatures to live in this Palestine, and when we say this, we're talking about the British mandate of Palestine. We're not acknowledging that Palestine was a country. It never was. Palestine, and I'm a native speaker of Arabic, is not an Arabic word. One of the nastiest persons who caused October 7th was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Hajj Amin al-Hussein. You often see him with Adolf Hitler. He did not become an anti-Semite when he met Adolf Hitler. He went to meet Adolf Hitler because he hated the Jews to death. Now, why? What was his motivation? I think he was very smart, not to praise him. And he was very ambitious. And he realized that the Zionists are very well organized, and that the Arabs of Palestine do not stand a chance. So instead of it staying a political conflict, he turned it into a religious one that will never end until one side eliminates the other. And obviously, the side that would win is the most hostile and the largest group. The Jews are dramatically outnumbered. How long can they last in the region? So Hajj Amin Husseini emphasized something that was known to Muslims, but not as relevant. The fact that the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa, and the Dome of the Rock are the third holiest place for Muslims, which were neglected, by the way, under Ottoman rule. You can go back to the archives and see on the internet that in the 20s, Hajj Amin al-Husseini sent emissaries around the world to Muslims to collect money, donations, and he used the donations to renovate the site. And towards the end of the 20s, they poured gold over the Dome of the Rock. So it became this pretty attractive site. And now they start teaching Muslims, you as a devout, decent person, have to fight for the site. It's one of our holiest sites, and the Jews want to strip us away from it. So it became a very complex political issue, but the motivation is religious. Many prominent and very problematic and controversial figures in the Muslim world evoke the old battles between the Jews and Prophet Muhammad in the West. I don't know if you understand it, because the slogan is in Arabic and it was coined towards the beginning of the First Intifada. Khaybar, Khaybar, Ya Yahud, Jayshu Muhammad, Sawfa Yaud, Khaybar, Khaybar, O Jews, the army of Muhammad will return. And it refers to the Battle of Khaybar. Khaybar was an oasis in the Arabian Peninsula, north of Mecca and Medina. And it was home to very wealthy Jewish tribes. It was an oasis in the desert. It had palm trees, it has a lot of dates, and it has water. And when the Jews, who originally took Prophet Muhammad in, treated him really well when he was chased out of Mecca, when they now retreated and they all gathered in this oasis and it was a fortress, they refused to join Muhammad to convert to Islam. He hated them. They were attacked. Every man was slaughtered, and the Muslims took the women and children, and they took the dates, and they took over this oasis. So the battle refers to that, reminding the Jews of what happened to them back then. And why would it be evoked? Why was it revived towards the beginning of the First Intifada? And the guy who coined this slogan is the founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the one in the wheelchair that Israel eventually assassinated. So a political conflict that is loaded by religious motives, which makes it very easy to mobilize masses against Israel for different reasons and in the name of human rights. You see today how easy it is to mobilize masses in the West. Not in the name of Islam, not because they owe Muslims the protection of their whole, one of their holiest sites. So it's a very, very loaded conflict, but it makes it very easy to incite hatred against the Jews.
So if Jews are religious infidels, where does that leave the Christians? So I hate to even put forward this hypothetical for obvious reasons, but there's about 15 million Jews in the world and somewhere between 1.5 and 2 billion Muslims. So as you said, sadly, it's a numbers game. So I'm going to pray, and I do believe that it won't happen, but should they accomplish their goal, perhaps not of destroying the Jewish people, but of destroying the Jewish state, what happened? At what point do they turn on the Christians, or Or will they turn on the Christians? What do the Christians
want? Why are we talking about it as if it's hypothetical? They're doing it to the Christians.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
First, Christians are being slaughtered in Africa.
That's
second,
true.
How many Christians live in the Arab world, in the so-called Arab world, our mm-hmm. region, the Levant, this part of the so-called Middle East?
Right.
The Middle East is a very Eurocentric term. But you know what we mean when we talk about the Middle East. But the Levant, this region that has today, for example, Lebanon and Syria, where my family comes from, we are always referred to as Arabs. Mm-hmm. We're not Arabs. We are Arabized. The Middle East and Northern Africa were Arabized when Islam, or during Islamic conquests. They were also Islamized. Larger, beyond the Middle East and Northern Africa, parts of the world were Islamized, but not necessarily Arabized. Take Indonesia, take Iran. They do not speak Arabic, but they're Islamized. So, how many Christians live still in the Levant where Jesus came from? How many Christians, you'd be shocked if you see the numbers, are left in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon? What is happening to the Copts in Egypt?
Right.
Systematically persecuted. Nobody cares about them.
Right.
If you look at Europe, it's still mostly a Christian continent. We have waves of immigration that caused the culture to transform.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly in some places and dramatically in others. And in those countries, what is happening to the Christians? They're not being slaughtered like in Nigeria, but today it is a thing. We debate whether you're allowed to serve in a very Christian school pork in your canteen, or are you allowed to take the children who are eight year old to the swimming classes? You as a teacher, in France or in Belgium or in Germany, you have to accept that out of the blue, now this child who's seven is going to come to your class wearing a veil. Things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, culture is shifting, morphing,
yeah,
because people are intimidated. Intimidated due to many terror attacks. They're afraid. They still see those images, what happened in the Bataclan, what happened in Charlie Hebdo, what happens when, like in metros, mm-hmm. those scenes scared people, shocked them. This is why in the name of tolerance, being kind, Muslim immigrants keep pushing the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Now that said, I have to mention something very important. Recently, an Afghan immigrant asylum seeker
mm-hmm.
killed two officers in...
He was granted asylum.
So he was
mm-hmm.
allowed to stay in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And after that, the reaction was to suspend all the applications of Afghans.
Mm-hmm.
Women live in hell in Afghanistan. And imagine that there are people who are not necessarily fond of Taliban, so they getting out of the country is an impossible mission. If you manage, you must be a supernatural person. Now imagine you manage to take a family out, you arrive to the USA, then an Islamist commits such an act of terror. And all Afghanis will pay the price collectively. Same applies in Europe. What I mean to say, a lot of people leave the Middle East because they do not identify with Islamism.
Mm-hmm.
They sometimes are atheists or homosexuals or they're liberals and they want a better future for their children. Now they come to Europe, and at the same time, Europe receives, or America receives, Islamists. And then they all have to pay the price collectively. There must be a smarter mechanism to be able to filter out jihadists. I don't know how, but unless you do this, you will see Christians under attack, assassinated in their own country while serving in the army in security.
It feels to me, so I didn't mean to negate the massacre that's going on in Nigeria and against other Christians in the world. What I really was referring to predominantly is the Christian West. And what I see is random one-off attacks that might kill one Christian or two Christians or three Christians because they're people and they happen to be Christian. But I don't see as of yet Islamic war being declared on Christians in the West the way that they are unapologetically in the streets against the Jews. So I'm just wondering how far off it is when instead of river to the sea, it's Atlantic to the Pacific, or, you know, when it's literally going to very ostensibly, very explicitly, or if, or will they rely more on birth rates and politics and getting the Mamdanis into, you know, into the big cities? Like, do you think that given the fact that there are more Christians, I think, in the world than Muslims, slightly more, that they would wage the same level of animosity against the Christians in the West?
They wouldn't be able to do it, to adopt the same strategy used against the Jews, against the Christians.
Right.
That's not possible.
Right.
Because until now, Christians dictate the rules in Australia, in the US, in Germany, in Sweden. So no, you cannot confront them and tell them openly, I want to turn your country into a caliphate. Although, mind you, it happened many, many times on the streets in demonstrations, people waving ISIS flags, people chanting in Arabic that they demand or they vow establishing a caliphate in Germany, in the Netherlands, and the police stands by. They do not understand what's being said, but you would think that they would recognize ISIS flag, and there must be a consequence to carrying that flag, especially in countries such as France. They suffered from terror attacks. They lost people. So it happened, but the war against the West, the Christian West, is different. And it's way more sophisticated. And it should be, the strategy should have become very visible after October 7th because anti-Semitism surfaced. But we realized how badly infiltrated academia, the educational system is. So why would Qatar, such a tiny country and super wealthy, invest more than any other country in humanity departments, in universities, in Europe, and in America? They fund, establish, train, finance those departments in order to push a political agenda.
Yeah.
That particular one is of the Muslim Brotherhood, which hopefully will be banned in the States. It is insane that the Muslim Brotherhood started in Egypt. It is banned in Egypt and not banned in the States.
Or in Israel.
It's insane.
Well, you know, of course, that within this proposed ban that started last week includes the exclusion of Qatar, of Turkey, of Syria. So it's like, well, okay, because yes, Qatar has infiltrated, and people are so focused on what they've done in our colleges. They have spent hundreds of billions of dollars on our K through 12 system too.
Educational system, not only universities.
Yeah, and people don't understand that. But they
established
also
think tanks. They started charity, like charity centers, mosques. Who works in the mosques? Who leads prayer? Who trains the imams? Who pays their salaries? When people convene and they're speaking in, I don't know, Urdu or Arabic or Turkish, do you have any idea what is being said there? They are very well organized. And these are institutions that you have to respect because these are houses of prayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of money. And not only that, I think now, after October 7th, we know how much they own, like especially when we talk about Qatar. Why would you be so keen on buying football teams, like clubs, on so many different levels, museums, businesses, properties? And they infiltrated the West. And we're just talking about Qatar.
And government.
This is only
Qatar. They own politicians too. I won't name them Donald Trump, but the money does not stop. So the problem is, like, how do we even sanction the Brotherhood when they're paying off the people who would sanction them?
I don't know. Maybe when investigations are conducted, you can weed out those who are corrupt, those who are collaborating, helping the Qataris advance an agenda. When we talk about the Qataris, we're talking about those who are invested in a jihadist Islamist agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are working relentlessly to bring the Western civilization down from within.
Mm-hmm.
Because Islamists are exploiting the weaknesses of Western democracies. And we're talking about Qatar, but a jihadist, whether they are Shia or Sunni, whether they are Muslim Brotherhood or Wahhabis, we still have a problem. They're all our enemies.
Well, the weakness of the democracy, ironically, is the democracy itself. For example, you can see how they've weaponized, in particular, the First Amendment, right? Everything is free speech. This isn't free speech. This is about calling for death to people.
Yeah.
And they call it a free speech issue, but at the same time, they don't want Jews to be able to speak. So if this were truly about free speech, they would be like, everyone should be able to say. And ironically, the pro-Israel voice has been pushed into the corner where we're the ones that have to say, yeah, well, let us talk, listen to them, but also listen to us. But the other side is saying, do not allow the Jews to have a voice. Do not allow the Israelis to have a voice. And so it's a weaponization that our weakness is our kindness. Our weakness is our tolerance.
In the West, if you want everybody to be represented, even the smallest fringe group, then you should allow them their space. And they come, Islamists as well, say, I also have the right to be represented, especially
mm-hmm.
if I, especially if I am a large part of your electoral base. So I am represented. This is how it works. 3 weeks ago, I was at the European Parliament in Brussels. So a Belgian politician, and Belgium has become Belgistan nearly. A Belgian politician said something very simple, straight to the point. Democracy is demography. That's it. Democracy is demography. The larger this electoral base becomes, they will push you. Of course, first of all, they will have their own politicians, or they will force any politician, if you want to be elected, voted in, you will have to offer concessions, you will have to listen to us, you will have to stop, I don't know what, going to Israel, should not receive an Israeli politician. We're talking about Israel because of who we both are, but in general, people don't understand. It is not about Israel. It is not about Israel.
Right.
So if Israel disappears, Islamists will no longer want a caliphate in the Netherlands or in the UK.
Right.
Imagine Israel gone, vanished. We moved it to Mars.
Yeah.
So the Islamists will be happy. Now they'll be satisfied.
Right.
They will stop veiling their girls when they're six.
Right.
Iraq recently, dropped the age of marriage for girls back to 9. We are regressing.
Yes.
This is unbelievable. Yes. So they will stop doing this if Israel disappears?
Right. And in getting back to the concept of the demographics, as Americans are in the West, we are not even reproducing at a replacement rate, because you have to have like a 2.2 or whatever birth rate in order to replace. And we're at like 1.5. And they're having, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 children. And so people have to understand that if the West is anathema to the rise of Islam, then fine, they don't have to kill us. They could just outbirth us. And I heard today that demographically that's going to happen in England by 2050. Now that
is said about many European countries. I don't know how accurate this is.
Yeah.
You look at the birth rates, and I've been living in Europe for 15 years, watching the continent transform. It's not against Muslims per se. I don't care how many Hindus live on my street, how many Muslims, how many Sikhs. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind. You can be Jewish, you can be an atheist, you can be a hipster, a hippie. I don't care. The problem when you have Muslim neighbors is that you have to be careful. You're walking on thin eggshells. Are they cool? Some are. Are they insane? Like they wouldn't let their wife out. We have in the region where I lived for many years in Germany. This guy arrives, he begs, he wants the apartment, blah, 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 and the owner is old and he's sweet, so he gives them the apartment for like half the price because he sympathized young couple. He brings the wife and she's like covered, and then nobody saw her. So this German old guy was concerned. Is she alive? They don't even open the shutters. And he said to him, well, because she's veiled, if we open the shutters, she has to cover her hair. And complicated. So the man said, no problem, we'll buy you curtains. This is the same. Then she had a baby and then she still wasn't allowed to leave. This is crazy. I'm asking, if Israel disappears tomorrow, Hasbe Khalil, God forbid, will those values become compatible with Western values? I'm not saying the West is perfect. There's a lot of room for improvement. But this is the best thing we have. This is the culmination of centuries of hard work trying to advance, to progress. And Islamists want to take us back to the 7th century. I don't want my grandchildren to be told what to wear. And this is why we are in this fight. It's not for Israel, it's for our kids. Do you want your granddaughter to be told what to... Sometimes they're not told what to wear. I have relatives, family members who live in the West, in beautiful Western cities. They don't. They watch what they wear because they're afraid of sexual harassment
from
Muslim immigrants.
Okay, I didn't know if you meant from locals.
No.
From
Muslim immigrants.
Does the face of Islam in Western Europe today differ from Islam of the Middle East? When's the last time you were in Lebanon or Syria? Or
2015.
Okay,
in
so
Lebanon.
Fairly recently.
No, actually, it was very sad. I stopped going to Lebanon because it's such a beautiful country. And the people have so much potential. It's a shame to see the country being Islamized at a rate. So when I grew up in Lebanon, it was very rare in the area where I lived to see a veiled lady. Last time I went to Lebanon, over the last years I visited, every time you go, it's like everywhere, even at the airport. It's strange. There are even women dressed in black in the chador that women wear in Iran. Like, it's a black, long, it's so bizarre. This is not the Lebanon I grew up in. And Europe started to remind me of the Middle East I left.
Okay.
When I think of what I don't like about Syria, you go to places in Europe and you're like, what is happening? People dream of buying a property in Saint-Tropez in South France.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can drive 40 minutes left or right, and you end up in an area where the signs are in Arabic, where people give you the
in
looks.
In Saint-Tropez?
Like, not outside Saint-Tropez, but in South of France,
okay.
Where people give you the looks like you're not welcome here. It's,
wow.
It's strange.
Did your parents ever talk to you about the how Lebanon transformed from a Christian to a Muslim nation? Like, did they ever talk about going through that transformation? Not I know they were secular, but just seeing the world around them shifting, did they discuss that with you at all?
No, because this was not an issue for them.
Okay.
In the 70s, in the 80s, even in the 90s, this was not an issue. Everybody had a Christmas tree, everybody drank alcohol, women dressed nicely. It wasn't an issue. When we visited my grandparents in Damascus every year, and we did only twice for the Hagim, for the Eid, and that was difficult for us,
mm-hmm.
because my grandparents were religious, especially my grandfather, and he would every time criticize the fact that my dad is sending us to a Catholic school. He would criticize what we're wearing, what my mom is wearing. He hated, like, he would always say something about her being Shia, something insulting. And my father had, like, every time had to say, I'm the dad, she's my wife, I'm happy with what they're wearing, none of your business. So it was hard. But we were aware,
mm-hmm.
that culture was way more conservative,
mm-hmm.
in Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very common, like many, many, many women were wearing the headscarf, not in Lebanon. And my grandfather used to talk about us as if the reason we don't wear the veil is that my mother is Shia. If she was a Sunni good woman, it would be different. No, it wasn't part of the Lebanese culture.
Mm-hmm.
But in Damascus, and we're talking about Damascus had even Europeans and Americans living there. So we're not talking about a remote region in Syria. This is the capital city. We were aware that it was very Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what my father would talk about. For him, it was like impossible to live there. He left Syria when he was 17. So we knew that he hated that culture. And if he drank whiskey, if we ever go to Damascus in the summer, he would always pour Coke. So that he doesn't offend anyone.
Right.
Although they all knew, but we were aware it's a completely different setup. And we knew that Lebanon is the coolest, the most European-minded,
right.
country. And that is no longer the case. However, after the last war, after the IDF gave Hezbollah a heavy beating, Lebanese returned to Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
with a conviction that, yes, many, with a conviction that Israel has done most of the work. Now it's time for us to take our country back. You'd
oh, wow.
be surprised how many
okay.
are even open to peace with Israel, to the point that last week, like a few days
yeah.
ago, there were direct negotiations
sure.
between the Israelis and the
yep.
for the first time, not
in
strictly.
Decades. Yeah.
Not strictly for the first time. Why I say this? Because they were recently, a few years ago, discussing maritime borders,
right.
because of the gas in, like, on the coast. And there were civilian experts included,
right.
in those talks.
Sure.
This time, more civilians were included. And maybe this will pave the way to normalizations. However, I was listening to the Lebanese Prime Minister in an exclusive interview today, and he said, we are open
yeah.
to peace with Israel,
but far from
not
yeah.
normalization, peace with Israel.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Under the condition.
Right, that the Palestinians have
get this act.
Yes, and so seeing as that's a non-starter, The Lebanese government has actually made a lot of overtures about disarming Hezbollah, for example, and yet nothing's being done. Now I'm personally unclear. Is this because they can't, or is it because
they
won't and they're just paying lip service to Donald Trump?
No.
Okay.
They really can't.
So
Hezbollah has become, in the past 2 decades, stronger than the Lebanese army.
Right. So I guess my next question is then, in a perfect world, okay, where there's no prior anything, pretend that there's no complicating factors, do you think that the Lebanese leadership, prime minister, president, would in fact like peace with Israel, but perhaps if the street were more vocally supportive of it, that they would move forward with it? I know that in Saudi Arabia, this is what's holding them back, is the feelings in the country. Now, you're saying that there's a lot more sentiment in the country that does want peace with Israel.
Yeah.
Should that minority become a majority, and should that majority become a vocal majority saying, we don't want Hezbollah anymore, we just want to live in peace, and we can't have peace if we don't have peace with Israel, do you think that the Lebanese government would take that step?
I'm not sure that those who are in favor of peace with Israel are the minority in Lebanon. Maybe there is a minority that is vocal, but this minority does not consist of 10 people. We're talking about hundreds who are very vocal, prominent figures, especially after the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah.
Mm-hmm.
He was the most charismatic figure in the so-called axis of resistance led by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And he was killed. And that broke the back of this axis of resistance, this axis of evil. So more people dared speak up. And now you hear politicians and journalists, activists, filmmakers, artists, students saying, enough already. Enough. We want peace with Israel.
Wow.
Of all ages, people are sick of this. For what? For what? We live in wars, or we lived through many, many wars for the Palestinian cause. And they remember what the Palestinian factions did to them.
Mm-hmm.
Just yesterday, we had lunch somewhere here in near LA, and I refused to go to a Lebanese restaurant with the Lebanese family who invited me. I said, like, I don't want them to recognize me. Let's go somewhere neutral. We went to a Greek restaurant. Our server, she asks him, where are you from? And he says, I'm Palestinian. Where from? Nablus. He's Palestinian, from Palestine. Okay. So he started talking about Israel. And the mother of this lady who was sitting with us, when he was talking about the Arab world, she said, my grandfather was the first killed in 1975 by the Palestinians. And maybe you don't know because you're young, my dear, but Palestinian factions crucified Christians in Lebanon. This is how they repaid us for our hospitality. So the Lebanese did not forget, and they're sick of it. It is very hard. The Lebanese diaspora is larger than the Lebanese population. They live abroad many, 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 many years without seeing grandmothers, not seeing their grandchildren.
Right.
For what? So that they can support them. They have the talents, they have the brains, they have a beautiful country. So why should you dream of having a visa, of going to Dubai? Dubai normalized with Israel. So why send your kids away to Argentina, to Canada, to Australia? We want to live there, but we want peace with Israel. This is the general mood. People are speaking up. Maybe you think it's a minority. It is not. The street is in favor. But that said, Hezbollah has become much weaker, but they still have many supporters who are willing to die for the cause. And about what you said, Saudi Arabia is not hesitating because the mood on the street is not in favor. You'd be surprised, especially in the Gulf countries, how much people are opposed and sick of the Palestinian cause. However, they do not want riots. They do not.
Right.
It's not that the average Saudi Arabian mm-hmm. is going to go and protest on the street. This doesn't exist in the Gulf.
Yeah.
But they don't want the Muslim Brotherhood or Islamists or terror organizations to stir the situation in, because the Gulf is heady. The Gulf countries are focused on investment, on building yeah. strong economies. So they cannot afford terror attacks. They cannot afford instability.
Yeah.
This is why they want to appease the Palestinians, and then we all make peace,
yeah.
and then we start building the region.
Yeah.
However, people do not understand what you're asking of Israel is too much,
yes.
is impossible after
exactly.
October 7th. You are gambling with the lives of the Israelis. They can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
This is why when the regime was overthrown in Syria, Israel destroyed the military infrastructure. They cannot trust someone who has such a past. Those who rid us of Bashar al-Assad, thank you so much, because they helped shut the corridor between Iran and Hezbollah. Thanks to the IDF, who weakened Hezbollah, otherwise Assad would have still be sitting in Damascus. But Israel cannot afford another attack like October 7th. And the borders with Syria are much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And there are at least, I don't have information, but at least thousands of jihadists who are willing to die for Al-Quds or Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to hear you talking like this primarily. Well, first of all, let me tell you where I got the Saudi thing. I got that from the Y. Al-Sharif. He's the one who told me that is the street that's stopping bin Salman from normalization right now. So that's just, that wasn't my, in fact, I was surprised to hear him talk about MBS's sincerity about wanting to join the Abraham Accords. So that's why I brought up the Saudi Arabia. That was, you know, firsthand information from somebody who, you know, is very close to MBS in that process. I think that what surprises me from what you're telling me, and by the way, I actually was going to ask, and I'm like, no, don't ask it. It's a stupid question. Because all the Lebanese I know also want normalization with Israel. And I'm like, maybe they're just saying that because they know I like Israel.
No.
And they're my friends. So I'm not surprised to hear that. But here's why I am. They were indoctrinated just as you were. You had a very specific awakening that because for time considerations, and because I'll go ahead and link some places where people can get your story. We're not going to get too much into that, but you had a very specific awakening in Europe that made you shift away from this appreciation for Hezbollah, for Islam, for radical Islam. But these people who are in Lebanon never had that. I mean, they have the internet. I mean, maybe that's it. But why do you think, is it just because they don't want to die, or is there something more fundamental? What shifted and how?
Very easy. Maybe I had an epiphany through a first encounter with Jews that helped me understand they're a normal people and they never hurt me directly. Why do I hate them? They're normal. But I didn't have social media.
Right.
Our generation
mm-hmm.
was limited. We had censorship and we didn't have access to information. Now, in the age of the internet and social media, people bypass anti-normalization laws and policies. So if I happen to have befriended an Israeli during my studies in Paris, I might risk being arrested if Hezbollah finds out after I return to work in Beirut. But can they arrest me if I watch a reel on Instagram? This is absurd. So everybody, whether they're in Iran or in Algeria, no matter how intensively indoctrinated, they have access to social media, so you can no longer omit the Israeli narrative
mm-hmm.
from their existence. So they put two and two together, and they understand that they are cool, they are normal, like the Israelis. And maybe they're not a problem, because, and this is my favorite conversation, that I have with people who think Israel is behind all ills of the world, like the Arabs. I ask them, so Your country does not criminalize domestic violence because of Israel. They do not recycle. The government is corrupt. The politicians are thieves, like embezzlement. Israel doesn't prevent anybody from reforming the educational system. They don't care. Actually, if you introduce reforms, you might become like the UAE. It's a win-win situation for everybody. Israel would benefit. Why would they prevent from becoming better? If they're not the problem. So people are waking up because they understand the hypocrisy. But especially in Lebanon, in 2011, the Arab Spring arrived in Syria. So there were riots and demonstrations and protests against Bashar al-Assad. And there were more than five decades of the Assad regime, the father and the son. And these are not just dictators, these are criminal, corrupt dictators, drug dealers, people who terrified the Syrian people. It was an Orwellian reality. Everybody in the Arab world knows about how notorious the intelligence apparatus in Syria is, how people disappear. The Lebanese know that very well because for very long, the Syrians occupied Lebanon, mm-hmm. and you had checkpoints everywhere. They would humiliate people, kill people, assassinate anybody who criticized them. So the Lebanese are traumatized. In 2004, finally, the same Lebanese who want normalization with Israel today, the same groups, the same parties, pushed and pushed and pushed until the Syrian army withdrew from Lebanon, leaving a very powerful Hezbollah behind. So in 2011, now Bashar al-Assad has a crisis and Hezbollah decides to help him. So Hezbollah says their raison d'etre, the reason why they exist is to liberate Palestine. Mm-hmm. Now they're helping a dictator kill the Syrian people. So this is where everybody said, a lot of supporters of Hezbollah, hold on a second. What do you mean you're helping him kill the Syrians? Why? He's a dictator, he's despicable. Why did they help him? Because again, remember I said he allowed the corridor between Iran and Hezbollah. So the shipment, the supply chain, the weapons, ammunition, etc., drugs, because they sell drugs around the world, and this is how they pay salaries. Again, another element that caused people to hate Hezbollah. There's so many different shipments of drugs that were caught mm-hmm. in Saudi Arabia or in Italy or in the Netherlands. So people lost respect for this party. And that is why there is no reason to perceive them as heroes anymore. So whatever they tell you about Israel, about the small Satan and the big mm-hmm. Satan, USA, became easier to dismiss.
Okay, so the irony here, of course, I know you have to leave shortly. You've got Shabbat dinner coming up, and we're going to have a secret sign. You're going to go like this when you need me to shut up. But
let's take five more minutes.
Okay.
Without this.
Well, you just did it. I think the irony is that it sounds like there are many in the Middle East who are waking up at the same exact moment that the West is falling asleep at the wheel. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the tremendous danger. I'll tell you the truth. I really wanted to talk more about your personal story, and maybe we'll do that another time if you're open to that. But because I did the thing, let's just wrap this up. I want to ask one more question, and I guess the question is, let's just, because we're sort of dancing around it right now, how significant do you think the Abraham Accords are? Who's going to be joining? And do you think they hold the key to Middle East peace?
Definitely. The Abraham Accords offered an alternative vision for our region. There is a very, very strong alliance, this axis of resistance, the axis of evil, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hezbollah, the Assad regime, that's now gone, and then Hamas, the Houthis, so they have proxies in the region, but also in Africa and in Europe and South America and in Canada, everywhere. Now they're weakened because they committed suicide. They opted for terrorism again and helped and supported and trained and supplied Hamas. Hamas were the buffoons who kickstarted the process that was meant as a final war against Israel. And while we have this very evil alliance that destroyed our region, look at all those countries I just mentioned. Look at their economies.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's just preoccupied. The leadership is preoccupied with destroying Israel. And now you have another alliance that was built. Now you have Israel, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan. And then bear in mind that Israel, although it's a cold peace, but has a peace treaty with Jordan and with Egypt. So it's not all doom and gloom. If you look at the region, it is actually stabilizing. It sounds crazy because we are witnessing a devastating war, but the situation is changing. We had a deadlock and things were stagnating, if not worsening. And October 7 was meant to obliterate every bridge that was built because of the Abraham Accords. But they did not manage. The UAE did not stop flying, like the flights did not stop to Tel Aviv. Trade did not stop. Research programs did not stop after October 7. October 7 managed to delay Saudi Arabia's joining the Abraham Accords, but Saudi didn't dismiss it, didn't say like, no, now that Israel waged this devastating war against the Gazans, against the Hamas, forget about it, never ever. No, it's not true. There are Israelis who are still visiting the country. Khaybar that I mentioned, the oasis, the fortress, that battle that became iconic because of Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who coined the slogan. If you go online, if you go on Google now, Google Khaybar Fortress, it's a tourism site. So the Saudis were preparing to make a big entry in the Abraham Accords to revive even the Jewish heritage in Saudi Arabia. So there is potential. I think we're gonna, it will regain traction, but we need Hamas gone. First, gone, weakened, humiliated. We need the PA to understand how critical the situation is. And we need to think out of the box. We have to stop recycling old solutions, hoping that the outcome will be different. No one-state solution, no two-state solution. We have to think out of the box, find a creative way to navigate our way out of this mess. So Saudi would join, Lebanon would join. I don't know what's going to happen with this crazy leadership in Syria, but eventually even Syria is open. Mm-hmm. And when I say Syria, I'm strictly talking about the people. Many are so tired of wars. They just want peace. And they know that Syria would benefit mostly from peace with Israel, not the other way around.
I don't think that most people even know that Assad killed about 500,000 of his own people. They're so concerned with the false genocide in Gaza that they don't even recognize that the Muslim genocides of other Muslims, not just Christians in Nigeria, but other Muslims have been horrific.
And why is that? Nobody allocated billions of dollars to wage a campaign against the Al-Assad, for example. It's not about human rights. 500,000 Syrians died. You can't even begin to imagine what happened in this country since 2011. Why there were no outrage on the streets? Because nobody funded this campaign. There is no political agenda against the West. Why would you benefit from a campaign against Assad? But a campaign against Bibi, against the Israelis, against the IDF, that is a completely different game.
Yeah.
Suddenly, sympathy is aroused and everybody cares.
Completely. Okay, I know we have to finish. We didn't even get to the fact that as an ex-Muslim and an atheist, you are now converting to being an Orthodox Jew and moving to Israel. I'm just going to leave that sentence for everybody who wants to look up her story online. It's everywhere. It's easy to find it. It's so inspiring. But I do have to ask you one last question. Mm-hmm. What do the words Am Yisrael Chai mean to you?
It means resilience, righteousness. People don't understand that because they are good, they are still here, because they have a mission, because they are your blessing, because they are your light. If you imagine anything other than that, you have no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea what is the fire, the light, the fortune the Torah brought to our world. And if you look at any evil agenda, look at the agenda of Islamists, they work against the Ten Commandments. But the terms, this terminology, this logic is very religious. Even the secular atheist Israeli is beautiful and they are resilient. And just yesterday I posted a video when I watched Idan Alexander, who was a hostage in Gaza, and after returning to Israel, he rejoined the IDF. And I was thinking, why did that move me to tears? And I realized that the secret behind this resilience is self-respect. They know that they are good. They trust themselves. They have so much self-respect. They don't want anybody to pity them. They share their story, but not for you to pity them. And I said, this, they're not victims. This is the fundamental difference between Israeli and Palestinian cultures.
Amen.
Am Yisrael Chai.
Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you so much for joining me. What a pleasure it's been. What an honor. And I hope to see you one day in Israel, maybe sooner than later.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.